Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're very glad to welcome you on behalf of Mayo Center. Thank you to our various participants. We have a galaxy of presenters and exhibitors, and we're delighted to welcome you. A very interesting cross-section of people. If you have a look around down the list of participants, you will see that we have a lot of people here who normally meet the other people here, which is one of the things we try to do with these occasions. I actually live in Chicago and work in Washington, but I'm over here in London quite frequently, and I chair the board of Mayo Center, and it's a treat to be able to join you today and introduce Rachel Bell, who is our director and who will take up the proceedings.
Thanks, Nigel, and I'd like to echo Nigel's welcome to everyone to this, the fourth in Bio Center's series this year, entitled People Power for the Third Millennium. We have had three symposia already this year, looking at robots and rights, cognitive enhancement, and privacy and surveillance. And if anyone has interest in learning a bit more what's said at those symposia, do take a look at our reports, which are available at the back to browse or to buy. Enough of that. Today we are here for our symposium on arts and technology, the role of the arts in democratic policy making. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome such a diverse audience. And I hope that this afternoon will offer each of us, from whichever perspective we come, the opportunity to think fresh thoughts about the power, potential, and indeed the problems of arts in the context of science policy making. We are dealing with three concepts, science, art, and democracy, which are sometimes thought to have little to do with each other. But I hope today that we will receive insights into the contrary position, namely that science, art, and democracy are indispensable to each other. It's my pleasure to welcome our chair for the afternoon, Dr. Rob Lafrenet, who is critic and curator at Arts Catalyst, the science agency, which has similar aims to those we have this afternoon. So welcome to you, and over to you, Dr. Lafrenet.
Hello, thank you very much for coming. I have to say I'm very impressed by the wide range of debates that's been addressed by Bio Center here. So very pleased to be associated with this. I think I'd like to say Arts Catalyst is not entirely new to this game. We presented to a large number of the public Critical Art Ensemble's Gen Terra at the Natural History Museum, which forced quite a lot of members of the public to make ethical decisions about transgenics. And we've also organized Symbiotica's bioart workshop, which put controversial biotechnology techniques into the hands of artists. And I was just going to also say that this afternoon, if we're going to get anywhere, I'd like to ask everyone and all the speakers is, do we really think, I mean, it's all very well to sit here in a collegial way to talk about openness in discussion of bioethics, but how much do we really want the genie out of the bottle? The reason I ask this is for personal reasons. I was looking online once again at the debate about vaccines, and there seemed to be so much emotion out there. There's so many entrenched positions on vaccines, it almost feels that the public debate is sort of slanting decision-making so much that it's impossible to make an ethical decision on vaccinating one's own child, for example, given the standard of debate. So are we going to be able to raise that standard this afternoon? Anyway, I'm sure in the Q&A we'll come on to some of those, but now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Andy Meir. Now, Andy was with us last week for a conference we organized, actually within the space exploration context in Glasgow. And he very cleverly wove together issues of bioethics and space ethics. Space ethics is another very interesting subject, because it's about sort of the territory, the new territory that the United Nations insists belongs to everyone, but perhaps space agencies with their own interests might want to lay claims to. And we've recently set up a committee for the cultural utilization of space. And one of the first things that went out of the window was a manifesto about ethics, because basically there would be, if we wanted people from space agencies to sit on the committee, there would be too many interests, too many vested interests for people to be able to take part fully. So Andy was there at the time, and I think the question of ethics, well, it does spread right across the board into various disciplines. So without further ado, Andy Meir.
Thanks very much, Rob, and thank you to the BioCenter for inviting me here to do this. And, you know, in case you were wondering what's the best gift you get at a space conference, because, you know, these conferences have exhibitors' halls, and you can imagine an exhibitors' hall at a space conference is pretty much as good as it gets. And so the best gift that I could find was this pen, which lights up. which we share, so we're already bonding. So, well, my talk, I think, is somewhat reflective of my own hybrid species condition. I have a background that is multidisciplinary. I worked in sociology and philosophy, studied a lot of applied sciences, and did a PhD primarily in bioethics, did a master degree in medical law, and over the last 3 or 4 years have worked closely with artists and designers, some of whom are with us. And so my interest has been to make those bridges between disciplines explicit and to try to find new ways of understanding the world around us by making those connections. So what I'll talk about for this 25 minutes I think I have, is partly what comes out of those collaborations, because I partly see myself, as Rob indicated, as a bioethicist coming to the arts, if you like, someone that's trying to encourage more imaginative ways of looking at quite standard traditional ethical issues, but also ways of imagining future issues, such as the use of genetic selection, for instance. And so all of my work, I think now, tries to make this put this interest to build bridges at the heart of what I do. What I'll talk through in this presentation is the culmination of a book project with the Foundation for Art and Creative Technology in Liverpool, FACT. And for me, this is not just propaganda for the sales, although, you know, we need to sell, but it's also a kind of dream project. It's, you know, you begin with a blank page and think, what would you, if you wanted to do the best book you could imagine, what would you do? And this, in some ways, really is that for me. So it is quite a special text. And a lot of the images, I think nearly all of the images you'll see are from the book, page proofs, etc. And this is also interesting because a number of people here will be at our launch in a couple of weeks on the 30th of October. I hope to continue some of these conversations. One of the difficulties I have with conferences sometimes is that they do seem to occupy their own space. And really trying to link the conclusions of meetings like this to ongoing communities of interest that are trying to develop new works and so on is something that's often forgotten. And so hopefully this will, it certainly will for me, be a way of trying to address some of these key issues that I think the BioCenter is highlighting by our having the debate. So if I begin with the questions that were posed to us through this seminar, I think the initial proposition I have is that hype and truth are not necessarily oppositional. So one of the questions had to do with whether the communication of science through artworks, through design, through texts, through science fiction perhaps, whether this in some way contributes to people's understanding of science, whether it leads to an unhelpful misrepresentation or distortion of what science is about. And this is juxtaposed against, supposedly, the scientific domain, which will, in response, either criticize such figurations or endeavour to put across its own. And I think it's our prime and initial responsibility to address the hype that is generated from within the science world itself. And I think there are a number of examples that alert us to this state of affairs. Craig Venter, who is interesting for a number of reasons, not least because he famously separated from the Human Genome Project to set up his own company, Celera Genomics, that was competing to map the human genome, ultimately beating them to it, but nevertheless co-publishing the Human Genome Map in 2000 in Nature and Science. Just last year, announced another big headline about the prospect of synthetic biology. I appreciate you might not be able to read the full text of this, but let me summarize, because I think the story of October 2007, when this became a live media issue, certainly in the UK, speaks to this relationship between scientists, governance, communication. So in, I think, October the 5th, 2007, The Guardian broke a news story that allegedly came out of Venter's company that they were creating, had developed a backbone to create new life forms. It was front page in The Guardian. It announced the prospect of new life forms being manufactured by humans. Very quickly, Venter's organization responded saying, The Guardian had been premature in its communication of this. We are not yet at the point of undertaking such work, but when we do so, it will certainly be communicated after we have published in leading peer-reviewed journals. And of course, this is one of those important characteristics of scientific work that we should not seek publicity for conclusions we have not had peer-reviewed. So the response was one of caution, one of misrepresentation, but I would propose that actually the leaking of this proposition could be read as a litmus test for public opinion. The Guardian front page was in some way a mechanism for understanding how the public would respond to such practices, and this, of course, can be instrumental to the responses of scientific bodies. So in this context, the communication, whether truthful or not, becomes a tool through which scientific institutions can try to manipulate and harness the media narrative that surrounds any particular event. Another example, which I think is not at the opposite end of the scale, but nevertheless somewhere quite far from that, is also from 2007. And this was the story of the Big Donor Show. And if some of you saw the Big Donor Show, this was a television program from the Netherlands, which was set up as a game show, the contestants of which were due to win a kidney. Each of them needed a kidney in order to survive. It would be, as you can imagine, the parameters of this show were like other reality game shows where you can send in your text to vote on who should receive the kidney and thus be able to live longer. And the advanced publicity for this program was phenomenal. It was throughout the world on the days before its broadcast. However, at the moment of broadcast, we see that the whole thing had been staged and set up to raise awareness of the shortage of organs within the Netherlands. I want to play you a bit of the clip. I've got a couple of clips I want to play you, so you can get a sense of it. Now, it's in Dutch, but there are subtitles. So you'll get a feel for the range of issues that I think are relevant to our scope of concern. So this is the audio.
Ik vind het echt afschuwelijk om te zeggen, Esther Claire, het spijt me.
Ja, reactie?
Heel graag een korte reactie.
Ik voel dan al wel een beetje aankomen, moet ik zeggen.
I will speak a bit. Just whilst you're watching this, we come in at the point where the decision's being made about who's going to get it.
Ik denk dat de... Ja.
Teleurgesteld.
Ja, dankjewel.
Graag. Dames en heren, toch een warm applaus voor Esther Claire. Ja. Vincent en Charlotte, dit is het uur van de waarheid. Eén van jullie beiden gaat zijn of haar leven verlengen met waarschijnlijk 23 jaar. Want een gezonde nier uit een levend lichaam gaat gemiddeld 23 jaar mee. Dat betekent 23 jaar niet meer dialyseren, 23 jaar gaan en staan waar je wil. Ervan uitgaande natuurlijk dat de nier niet afstoot. Ik ben zelf helemaal koud van de spanning, dus voor jullie moet het helemaal niet meer te houden zijn. Lisa, het is bijna een onmogelijke keuze. Sta jij volledig achter die keuze?
Ja, ik sta er helemaal achter. Ik moet gewoon kiezen, hoe moeilijk en afschuwelijk ook. Maar ik heb mijn keuze bepaald.
Ik denk dat we de mensen dan niet meer langer in spanning moeten laten zitten. Wordt het Vincent of wordt het Charlotte? Ik vraag aan jou om bekend te gaan maken wie binnen nu en één maand een niertransplantatie krijgt. Wiens leven ga jij drastisch veranderen? Vincent en Charlotte, haal diep adem, want de uitslag gaat nu bekend worden gemaakt. Lisa, heel Nederland wil nu van jou weten wie krijgt de nier. Maak nu alsjeblieft je definitieve keuze bekend.
De persoon aan wie ik mijn nier het allermeeste gun, is iemand die me heel erg geraakt heeft deze avond. En die persoon...
Even wachten, Lisa. Wacht heel even. Want ik wil even een time-out, want ik wil eigenlijk nog een keer die vraag stellen. Waarom zijn we hier en waar zijn we nou eigenlijk mee bezig? Wel, dat is omdat het heel treurig is gesteld met de orgaandonatie in ons land. Anno 2007 staan er ruim 1400 mensen op een wachtlijst voor een orgaan, terwijl de kans dat zij die ook zullen ontvangen alleen maar kleiner is geworden. Maar daar is wat aan te doen. Door een donorformulier aan te vragen met een sms'je of natuurlijk op pnn.nl. Wij geven vanavond geen nier weg. Dat vinden wij zelfs te ver gaan. En Lisa, of moet ik zeggen Leonie, want Lisa heet eigenlijk Leonie en is een actrice en is gelukkig kerngezond. En Esther Claire, Vincent en Charlotte zitten ook al heel lang in dit complot. Alleen zij met z'n drieën, zij zijn geen acteurs. Zij zijn drie echte nierpatiënten en het verhaal wat zij verteld hebben is hun eigen verhaal en dus bittere realiteit.
Okay, so you get the picture. This was a complete hoax for the Dutch television audience, as well as it was for those people watching it covered on the news. The fallout was controversial. People felt deceived, but I would argue something meaningful and valuable had taken place. And I think there are other instances, and you'll get the sense that I include these as part of my own appreciation of how artistic endeavor, creative cultural endeavors contribute to these conversations is central to how we look at art and how we think about the boundaries around art. And there are other examples of this. I think that if we look at any number of controversial issues within the world of biotechnology, we see examples where some form of communication is leading to some level of understanding, even though scientists might claim that it's being misrepresented. Let's do one more clip. Because one of the big issues that has been talked about in this context is stem cell research. So we've got a very short clip of the coverage of stem cell research within a comedy show.
Strong feelings on both sides. Good people can disagree. But there are 100 senators. At least one of them must have had the courage to stand up in front of his colleagues and bring the crazy.
I got a picture of a bald eagle egg and a bald eagle.
Crazier.
If I ask my 8-year-old children, what happens if I destroy this egg? Will I get this eagle? They will say, no, you don't get the eagle if you destroy the egg. Well, why not? That egg's not an eagle. Well, I know, but the egg is the eagle because the eagle comes out of the egg.
The eagle comes out of the egg. By that logic, Senator Brownback is a vagina. I'm going to guess that that sentence has never been uttered. But the stem cell prop comedy of Sam Brownback did not stop there.
This is a particular person, a young girl named Hannah that I just met with a few hours ago. This was when she was adopted as a frozen embryo. This shows her kind of development taking place.
I've taken the liberty of bringing in her placenta. You can pass it around. It's, be careful. Obviously, it's seen better days.
This is a chart she did last year when she was in Washington. And she draws three pictures down here below. This is her smiling because she got adopted. She's here. There is another frozen embryo. These are embryos that's sad because he's still sitting in a frozen state. And then here's one that, as she explains, is saying, "What, are you going to kill me?"
I have to say, if you have a talking embryo who is cognizant enough to wonder if you're going to kill it, I say we don't do research on those ones. And if we find them and identify them, perhaps one of them will grant us three wishes.
Okay, so these in my mind are instances of the arts contributing to democratic policy making in the context of science. They are, I think, for many people, a world away from other such manifestations of art forms that contribute to that sort of discussions, those sort of discussions that we should be having about a range of practices, a range of assumptions, a range of cultural values that are in need of greater scrutiny. Mark Quinn's sculpture, its particular location within Trafalgar Square, I think is another instance of that democratic policy making being affected by art. The visibility surrounding disability is one aspect that I'll come back to. But I think one of the initial conclusions, if you like, is that the one of the problems we have already is to draw boundaries around the arts. And certainly it's no secret that there are clear boundaries around specific sectors of the arts. And I think we can do better to build links across those. I think another problem that surrounds it, however, is the different agendas that operate around arts practices as opposed to science policy, science communication, which are primarily, the latter of which are primarily interested in communication for the sake of engaging people to understand science, where arts are more often than not, I think, resistant to such expectations. In some ways, what defines art is its subversive capacity, whether it's political or not, I think it is neither here nor there, but the capacity to draw attention to assumptions that need to be brought into question, I think is central. But I think there is a context for this that is helpful. These worlds are not so far apart. The arts and scientists are both in the business of trying to develop new ways of seeing the world. They might operate with different notions of truth, but here we have Francis Crick's initial drawing of the DNA helix, which I think is one instance of that artistic manifestation. And if you look at a number of artists that are working around biologists, around scientists, bio-arts artists, as Rob mentioned, these are people who are trying to understand and work within the scientific method to find ways of making it manifest through artworks. And again, we have other historical origins to this set of relationships. So I think, in some sense, the relationship between arts and scientists and the governance, in fact, of both, I think is in good shape. I think we also inhabit our art forms. I think that around us, within this building, we see examples of those connections between art and science. The materials that go into constructing buildings is one example of that. This building from Beijing is another instance of that manifestation. And I think if one looks at architecture, you perhaps have a much more balanced relationship between artistic vision and scientific practice that underpins the imagination of new spaces, new environments. But I think one of the questions that also should concern us is where art takes place. So if we think about art as a route towards democratic policy making about science, about technology, we might ask into where these environments are that art takes place. These spaces that you see depicted here within this map might be seen as the formal environments where art takes place. And yet within them, I think a number of different practices are going on. So it isn't just galleries, it isn't just exhibitions, it's also other social spaces. They also constitute other social spaces where a range of activities take place, whether it's children's workshops, whether it's artist workshops, debates such as this, I think, are instances of that. And so one of the main messages, if you like, is that this proposition that art could contribute to democratic policy making is somewhat tautologous, in part because it is inseparable from democratic policy making. It is constitutive of democratic policy making. And for the cynics around us, or those realists perhaps, this is not to say that artists or arts institutions shape the level of funding they get in the way that we might want to ensure the arts are adequately funded. Certainly, if one thinks about the Olympics in London and its effect on the funding of arts institutions, it seems hard to make that case. But I think coming to terms ideologically with the relationship between art and science is critical. So other ways in which I think art engages with practices that are broadly scientific as well, conceptually related to the practice of science, is through allowing us to look at things differently, to change our perspective on the world around us, whether it's in a very physical sense, through something like 3D technology. I think this is a nice example of a renewed way of looking at this kind of science. There's a lot of interest around cinemas at the moment to use 3D technology to think about new ways of filmmaking, and lots of challenges to that as well. But it is nevertheless, I think, an interesting example of that interaction, that new way of participating within the world around us. I think also what art allows us to do is to develop new hypotheses, to develop new propositions about the state of the world. And we might think of this in a sociological sense. We might utilize art or design to generate new ways of relating to each other. And in turn, that changes our relationship, it changes the way we live, and we can see this, I think, in many ways on an everyday level. If one thinks about this auditorium and considers the kind of space that it is, in what ways does it reflect a certain acoustic advantage that lecture halls ought to? In what ways is it different from other sorts of spaces? These are the sorts of conditions that I'm talking about when thinking about how art changes our perception on reality. I think those sorts of questions about how we set up spaces are critical. I think science and art both also try to resituate our expectations. I think the sorts of views that one might have about our genes are, in a very complex way, and perhaps more predominantly informed by artistic practices. You know, you only have to look at the media to see how genetics still is referred to in the context of this Frankensteinian narrative. You know, what other metaphors might we try to generate to imagine this prospective future? And I think that's, again, what art can contribute through presenting new ways of looking at similar issues. This work is from some digital artists, and the work is called Eternal Youth. In some ways, it provokes anxiety about the future. It situates us within such issues as surveillance, about medical transgressions that we might have to undertake, and offers a new aesthetic through which to engage with those issues. I think also in terms of how artists and scientists work, there are interesting parallels the degree to which any, I mean, even the DNA helix is still controversial, right? It's supposedly Crick and Watson, but Rosalind Franklin is still present there, and people refer to this unwritten history of its characterization. So this idea that somehow scientific endeavors are individual eureka moments, I think, is also misleading, but similar to artistic processes as well that happen within collaborative environments. I think also what art does that can assist us, and for those of you that work within the area of science communication or the public engagement with science, is to bring into question expertise. So if you work, you know, for example, one of the current trends in, well, it's sort of transcending the digital culture world, but it's, you've heard of the unconference, right? Have you heard this term? So the unconference, the philosophy is, you know, no one has a particular expertise. We all have something to bring. No one should be standing up here speaking. We should all be talking to each other. This is a kind of system of conferences that emerged in digital culture as collaborative ways of sharing knowledge. And this is infiltrating, I think, other spheres of life. And I think that questioning of knowledge hierarchies is an integral part of what art does. It brings into question the nature of expertise and hopefully throws it into turmoil. I think Rob mentioned the Critical Art Ensemble, the story of someone like Steve Kurtz. And if you've not read anything about Steve Kurtz, then I encourage you to look up some of his work. Steve Kurtz was or is someone that could be termed a bio-artist whose work attracted the attention of the United States FBI, who thought he was developing bioterrorist weapons through his artworks, and he was subject to a criminal investigation. It became quite a big deal for the artistic community when someone became subject to this kind of investigation. But in some sense, I think the work of someone like Steve Kurtz really encourages us to think about one whose territory is new biology or creative biology, if you like, but it also asks us to think about the ethical issues of science, which people are allowed to work within laboratories. What is it one has to do to have that sort of privilege, if you like? Whose spaces are these environments? Other artists achieve this as well, I think, in their work. They bring into question certain concepts that are scientifically known to people, but they visualize them in ways that transform those understandings. This is an example of Jan Marosic, who, as you can get a sense of in this picture already, he sweats, his body sweats an ink. He digests an ink, and it sweats through all his pores, and he stays in a box for about 30 minutes, and eventually he turns completely blue through sweating. And there's a scientific process. Yeah, I can imagine if someone works in science communication, this is a wonderful way of explaining the process of perspiration and visualizing it in a very different way. But I think what artists do in that sense, in some ways better than these, I dare say, although two friends of mine have done the Christmas lectures, you know, better than that sort of setup where you're demonstrating scientific principles through different, mock experiments. I think they do it in some sense, but I'd really love for someone like Jan to be paired up with a scientist to do the Christmas lectures, because it would be, I think, all the richer for it. And to get to a conclusion, because I think I'm probably about there, Rob doesn't care. I'm yeah. So I'm going to wrap up. I left my phone down there, so I don't know what time it is. I'm going to wrap up in a couple of minutes. But so just to conclude then, really, I think one of the central aspects of our debate is that these relationships are visualized by artists. You know, there's our job is not to say, well, how can scientists work better with artists to communicate science? That's a side issue to what we should be about. I think that the okay, thank you very much. My apologies. Okay. I'll do my best. So our task is not to find, these things are already happening. It goes back to Craig Venter. These people are manipulating the media with their very aggressive mechanisms, and I think that it's inevitable that these things should come closer together. And well, maybe that's where I'll finish. Okay, thank you very much.
I think we're having all the questions. Unless there's any particular points of fact you want to bring up with Andy, we're having questions in the Q&A. Oh.
Okay, thank you.